at the end of our last segment, before we went to the top of the hour news and commercial break, Jason was making a point about the deceptive nature of Islam. So before we commence on that discussion, I'll let you restate your position, Jason.
Well, when you were speaking of the Muslim guy a couple weeks ago, and how, you know, there are those that are actively trying to misrepresent Islam to
people
who still have
a gullible nation in terms of its academic institutions and media. And in his particular case, he took two statements from the Quran to give the impression that that Boko Haram had not read the Quran. And both of the statements that he took out of the Quran in context say exactly the opposite of what he was inferring. It's just a deliberate lie.
Yeah. And it just dawned on me at that time that, the Muslims in the West and other non-Islamic countries, they're essentially doing the same thing, whether it's actively or intentionally.
Right.
They're misrepresenting Islam by being peaceful,
by claiming to be peaceful when the imam says, you know, we don't preach violence here, and where they're claiming that they are peace loving people and just want to be part of the community. One of two things is true, with 100%.
A Muslim part of the community here in Canada that apparently he hit his daughter so hard she died.
Yeah, in fact, you've had a bunch of what they call honor killings in Canada, where husband and wife have come together to murder one or more of their daughters. It's pretty common. Young Muslim women have absolutely no rights in Islam, and it's therefore it's difficult for Muslim men to try to raise their daughters in particular in a non-Islamic country, because the rights that women are afforded in a non-Islamic country are so radically different than what they have. You know, I think you have just two groups of Muslims in the West. Those that know the truth about Islam, which means they're a good Muslim. They've read the Quran, they've read the Hadith, they know that Muhammad was a ruthless terrorist, and they know that Allah only allows jihadists into his paradise. They know the truth, and therefore they're deliberately lying. The Muslim man, Muslim guy, he's a deliberate liar. He knows the truth. He's just he makes a living by lying. And in Islam, those who lie on behalf of the religion are considered good Muslims. Well, the Islamic view on lying is the antithesis of the view that Yahweh wrote and etched in stone. The second is that within every religion, there's very substantial number of people who haven't got a clue. They really don't have a clue. They, if they do go to a mosque, they just go because that's how they were raised, and they go and they bow as they were told to bow, and then they leave. If they fast at a particular time, they're doing it just because this was the tradition. They've never read the Quran. They've never read the Hadith. They've got no clue who Muhammad was. They're really bad Muslims. And it's possible to be a good person and to say good things so long as you're a bad Muslim. But you can't be a good Muslim and be a good person. So you're right. There's two forms of deception.
And with only, what is it, five books that comprise, you know, Islam's teaching and whatnot, what else could they possibly be learning in their mosques?
Yeah, it's true that there's only five books that were compiled within 200 years of Muhammad's death. And those are the Quran, which appeared in writing a little over 100 years after Muhammad's death. Sirah, which is the biography of Muhammad, compiled by Ishaq, about 125 years after Muhammad's death. And the Sirah by Ishaq presents Muhammad as a ghoulish thug, as a sexual pervert. So, I mean, it is horrendous in its presentation of Muhammad. And then you have Tabari's Hadith collections, his Tariq, which is the history of Islam's formation. He was the foremost Quran scholar of his day. In fact, his commentary on the Quran is considered the best ever written in Islam. And he compiled a history of Islam by putting Hadith in chronological order. He did so about 175 years after Muhammad's death. And then you have two topical collections at the same time, one by Tabari, one by Muslim. Those are the only five sources compiled within 200 years of Muhammad's death. There is nothing more to Islam than that. Anything else that you would throw into the hat is even further removed from what he said and did. And so if you're going to be teaching anything about Islam, all you've got is those materials, and those materials are uncivilized. They're grotesquely immoral. They're perverted sexually. They endorse terrorism. It's a declaration of war on all humankind. You can't deliver a sermon from the Hadith or the Quran that would encourage good behavior. Can't be done.
Yeah, and I was particularly disturbed the last couple of days just when I learned that this guy, who apparently was a Muslim, who struck his daughter, ruptured a vein in her neck, and I believe I heard that it basically caused her to die. Mm-hmm. Well, she did die, but it was from maybe circulation to her brain or something like that. And he was given, he was sentenced to 60 days.
Wow. Wow. You murder your daughter, and you get 60 days in jail.
Well, they chalk it up to an accident, you see.
Yeah, but you know, when even if it was reckless endangerment or involuntary homicide, when it's a physical blow, when a man strikes a woman, and here he's striking his daughter, he's strong, she's vulnerable. When a man strikes a woman and she dies, even if you can't claim that he had no premeditation in terms of striking her. You can say, well, he just meant to punish her, but not kill her. It's still grotesquely inappropriate for a man to strike a woman that hard. I can't even fathom how he wouldn't get less than 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, I just the blood kind of left my face there, and I was thinking, you know, how can that possibly be sentenced?
Yes.
For that kind of crime.
For that kind of crime.
Yeah, I'm going to run something by you, Yada. I was wondering, you know, you were talking a bit with Glenn about some eschatology and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I just wondered, you know, like, you see a judge make a sentence like this, and mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, like, people that are actually, who are not part of the covenant,
mm-hmm.
not, you know, they're Torah-less, essentially, their judgment, to see, like, maybe it would just continually decline, and
yes.
Maybe the migration of the remnant of Israel would be partially because the west of the world will become uninhabitable.
Yeah, it's true. That is absolutely true. Collectively in the West, we've lost our ability to exercise good judgment, which you saw in that court case is a wonderful example of it. I'm confronted almost every day when I read stories in the judicial system in America that we do not have a justice system. We have a legal system, and it's badly broken in this country. And the legal system that is badly broken in this country is still better than most, which tells you how far we have fallen. It is going to be true that Yahweh in the second half of the 18th chapter of Yeshayah says specifically that he has to remove his children from America to protect them in Israel. That we become so grotesquely immoral here that God himself has to remove his children from this country.
Is that for me? I wouldn't mind looking that up.
Yeah, it's in Yashaya. What I'll do for you, send me an email at yada@yada.com. Send me an email at yada@yada.com, and I will send you the chapter because it's not yet posted. It's one that I wrote here a few months ago. And in it, God is concurring with your conclusion that man is going to lose the ability, and it's extraordinarily prevalent, he says, in the United States. But we lose our ability to be moral. And that's why he has to bring his children back to Israel. Even though Israel is being pummeled by Muslims, he has to bring them back there to protect them.
Wow, that's, I hope there's a little bit of relief up here, north of, your border.
Yeah, I hope so too. But, you know, the sad situation, for us all is that most religious people, like the Catholic Pope, have completely squandered their ability to be rational. I mean, it's impossible to be an informed and rational Christian of any ilk, much less a Roman Catholic, which is probably the worst of the various denominations of Christianity. You cannot be an informed and rational Roman Catholic. You can't be an informed and rational Christian. But the same thing is true as Islam. You know, if you're informed, you can't be a Muslim if you exercise any degree of rational thought.
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting to bring that up because, yeah, I thought the other day too, you know, if you establish a nation mm-hmm. according to Paul's gospel of grace,
yes,
you would have an absolute disaster.
Yeah, you would. Yeah, no accountability.
But
no knowledge required, no judgment required, no accountability. Everything is forgiven. Yeah, you would, it's so hypocritical because he condemns all sorts of behaviors and tells people they have to obey him. And then he says everything is forgiven. You know, we also have the problem of the educational system with socialist secularists also losing judgment. I'd like to turn to the chronology of statements from Yahusha, something we promised to do yesterday, that after Yahusha was speaking to Satan, rebuffing Satan's enticements by quoting the Torah, he then began what is referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. Now, there's no sermon. It was a instructive presentation on the Mount. It's the first public presentation. It's the longest speech he makes. It is the one of many parts of Yahusha's testimony that there is no Christian that wants to consider. What he had to say completely destroys the myth of Christianity. So the first words out of his mouth and his first public declaration in his longest, most comprehensive presentation of who he is and what he's doing has him completely destroy the credibility of a religion that would claim to be based on him. He began, "You should not think or assume that I actually came to tear down, invalidate, put an end to, or discard the Torah or the prophets. I actually came not to create a division. I actually came not to create a division, to dismiss or to invalidate, to discard, but instead to completely fulfill, to proclaim, to complete, to convey the true meaning, to liberally supply them. Because indeed and in truth, I say to you, until with absolute certainty the heaven and earth cease to exist, not ever under any circumstance shall one aspect of the smallest letter nor a single stroke of the pen cease to be relevant from the Torah. until with absolute certainty everything might take place. Therefore, whoever may at any time dismiss or attempt to do away with one of the smallest and least important of these prescriptions and instructions, which are enjoined, and he may instruct or indoctrinate people likewise in this manner, he will actually be provided the name and will be judicially and legally summoned as lowly and little in the kingdom of heaven. And then whosoever might act upon it, this would be the Torah and prophets, and teach the Torah and prophets, this will be properly referred to and named great and important among those who reign in heaven. This is Matanyah, which means Yahweh's gift, 5:18, 17, 18, and 19. Christianity can't survive those words, not in an informed and rational world. And yet Christians will say, all right, you know, what he meant by he came to fulfill the Torah, he did away with it. And think about how stupid you'd have to be to make that claim in the midst of what I just read. How to make the claim, when he said he came to fulfill it, that meant he was doing away with it. In the midst of a statement where he says, don't think for a moment that I'm coming to do away with the Torah. Don't think for a moment there'll be any aspect of the Torah that will be annulled. Even the smallest letter or the stroke that comprise the letters of the Torah while the heavens and earth exist. And you would take that from its context to say, well, yeah, what he was doing was just contradicting himself. I mean, again, to be a Christian, you have to either be ignorant, which means you do not know what Yahusha said and did, or you have to be irrational, that you know that he said this, but that you can't process it rationally, that you are unwilling or unable to go where this leads. And this is as clear as words allow. You can't be any more direct than this. This is absolutely unequivocal. And it's written down by an eyewitness. The person who wrote this down was one of his disciples. This is from the book of Matanyah. There is absolutely no way to do away with this. This is his longest speech, his first speech, his most comprehensive presentation. And he begins by saying, do not think that I have actually come to tear down, to invalidate, to put an end to, or to discard the Torah or the prophets. And yet, two-thirds of the message in Christendom's New Testament claims otherwise. Half the letters written by Paul. Truly is amazing that Yahusha's first public statements, the beginning of what's found in the so-called Christian New Testament, destroys the religion of Christianity before it's even conceived. And that you have testimony here from the individual that Christians mistakenly think is the creator of their religion, the one that they pray to, although they don't know his name. They don't know him, that he doesn't want you to pray to him, doesn't want you to worship him, doesn't want you to really to pay him any attention. He wants you to look right through him to see Yahweh. And yet this religion is based on Paul's letters, where Paul says that the Torah can't save, that the Torah has been annulled and done away with, that the Torah is invalid, that the Torah is mean-spirited, that the Torah is arcane, and that the Torah has been replaced with his gospel of grace. And yet, Yahusha says exactly the opposite. So how can Paul be telling the truth if he claims to be representing Yahusha when Yahusha's statement is the opposite of Paul's statements? You either have to be ignorant of what Yahusha said to believe Paul, or you don't care that they're directly contradictory and there's no way to reconcile them. You know, and for the pathetic Christians that say, yeah, I know that's there, but he said that he is fulfilling them, and fulfilling means to do away. No. When you fulfill a promise, you don't do away with the promise. You actually highlight the promise by honoring it. You acknowledge that the promise exists by honoring it. You know, a promissory note is a promise to pay. You know, it's a, when you fulfill an obligation, you are doing what you promised that you were going to do. You don't eliminate the obligation. You don't, it doesn't make it, you know, the only way you can fulfill an obligation is to acknowledge that it exists and to do as you promised that you were going to do. Now, in terms of the Torah's promises, there are many Torah promises that have not yet been fulfilled. You know, and I would say that you're dealing probably with half of them. In terms of the Mikra themselves, the first four have been fulfilled, the last three have not. And he says that this Torah is going to remain full in effect until they're all fulfilled. And there are so many promises, so many prophecies, so much information as to what's going to happen over these next 20 years. It's materializing in before our eyes, but it's a long way from being fulfilled. And so, in context, here's Yahweh's first public statement, and he says, he begins with a line that is the antithesis of Pauline doctrine, the antithesis of the Christian religion. The Christian religion hates the Torah. It pays no attention to the Torah. It looks at the Torah as an arcane set of laws that have been annulled, that no longer have any value, and that were never intended for them. And yet, the very individual that they claim is the founder of their religions said, you should not think or assume that I actually came to tear down, invalidate, put an end to, or discard, to katalu, to dissolve, destroy, disunite, subvert, overthrow, abrogate, weaken, dismantle, or abolish, releasing or dismissing any of the implications, force, influence, or validity of the Torah or the prophets. I actually came not to create a division, to dismiss, to invalidate, or to discard, to dissolve, to destroy, to disunite, to subvert, to overthrow, to abrogate, weaken, or dismantle the Torah and prophets, but instead to completely fulfill. It is interesting, by the way, the fact is that Yoshua was having this conversation in Hebrew, not in Greek, and all we have is a translation of it in Greek, and the reason that is so is that rabbis around 70 and again around 135, 133 to 135, went to war against those who acknowledged that the Messiah Yahusha was the living embodiment of the Torah, and they burned every copy of Matanyah that was written in Hebrew. In fact, the Talmud is filled with statements as to how they hunted them down and burned them. Copies of this book that were written in Hebrew. So all we have now is a translation into Greek. And yet the words in Greek are absolutely unequivocal. The point I wanted to make in terms of this last part is that Yoshua is speaking of the Torah and of the prophets. And yet when he's talking about not creating a division, not dismissing, not discarding, it's not them, but it's it, singular. And that's hard for us to process in English because we think of the Torah and the prophets as separate things. And he says, I did not come to invalidate the Torah and prophets, it. I came to fulfill it, not them. Now, the only way that the Torah and prophets are an it, singular, is if God views that his testimony from beginning to end, in the beginning in the book of Bereshith and ending in the last of the prophets, whether it's Zechariah or Malachi, is one indivisible communication. That's one of the two explanations that God views that what he began in Bereshith in communicating the opening book of the Torah all the way through the last of the prophets, which should either be Malachi or Zechariah, that is one single, united, inseparable entity. And it would also mean that his teaching, his Torah, permeates his prophetic testimony, and it does. It also means that his prophets are among that Moshe, who scribed the Torah, would be considered a prophet, and that the Torah is therefore a prophetic book, which it is. So for it to be an it, you have to have all of the following things unified. That everything from the first book of the Torah all the way through the last of the prophets is one inseparable communication. And number two, that there is Torah teaching in the prophetic books, and also that the Torah is a prophetic book. That's the reason why he's referring to them as an it. But I did not come to create division, to dismiss, to invalidate, or to discard it, but instead to completely fulfill it. Because indeed, and in truth, now recognize that the opening line of that statement makes it impossible for anyone to say that to fulfill means to discard, to do away with, because he began this by saying, you should not think that I came to do away with. And the conclusion does the same thing. It precludes the Christian excuse, leaving them with no excuse, absolutely destroying the religion. And it's not mean to expose the fact that the Christian religion is destroyed by the testimony of Yahusha. Because it's mean to leave people with false hope. That's what's mean. What's mean is to know the truth and not share it. To leave people in the dark. To not care enough about their souls to be willing to tell them the truth. What we're doing here is extraordinarily loving and caring. Not loving of the religion of Christianity, but loving their victims, loving the religion's victims enough to tell them the truth. It is impossible for Christianity to be true. Impossible. There is absolutely no set of circumstances whatsoever based upon Yahusha's testimony that Christianity is anything other than a pile of lies and false hope. Because indeed, and in truth, Amin, I say to you, until with absolute certainty the heaven and earth cease to exist, not ever under any circumstance shall one aspect of the smallest letter or a single stroke of the pen cease to be relevant from the Torah. Until with absolute certainty, everything might take place. Last time I checked, the earth was still here. Last time I checked, the universe was still here. Therefore, not any aspect of the Torah has been invalidated. Now, this is really an interesting statement, because it conveys something that is profoundly important to understand. And that is that at this time, there were many aspects of the Torah that could not be honored as if they were rules that you had to obey. They couldn't be honored because the Levitical, which are really Lowy priesthood, at this time didn't exist. They were essentially replaced by those who usurped their authority called rabbis. And within just a matter of 40 years of this time, the temple itself wouldn't exist. So there was huge swaths of it that could not be done in the way that the Torah itself was explained to them. And so what you recognize at that point is that he is speaking of the Torah as being teaching, as being guidance, as are the prophets, filled with guidance, filled with teaching. There isn't a single stroke in the Torah that has been annulled while the heavens and earth exist, which means that all of it serves to teach us. All of it serves to enlighten us. All of it serves to guide us. You know, even the descriptions of the measurements of the tabernacle, even of the furniture in the tabernacle and in the temple that no longer exist, even with the mercy seat, which is not accessible, even with the original autograph of the Torah, every bit of it can be learned from. Every bit of it's instructive. Now, there's a really interesting aspect of this transitional statement, because indeed and in truth I say to you that with absolute certainty that until the heavens and earth cease to exist, not under any circumstance shall even one aspect of the smallest letter or single stroke of the pen cease to be relevant from the Torah. Now it's interesting here, I mean there's so much here that's interesting. One is he didn't say the Torah and prophets anymore. So it's just the Torah. So he's emphasizing the Torah, which is the first five books, maybe six, depending on your view of Yahusha. He's also still including the prophets when you recognize that he used it singular previously, which means that there's teaching throughout the prophets, and there is. Now, there's a reason here that he just didn't say that the Torah is going to continue with every jot and tittle, the smallest letter and the strokes of every letter are going to continue to be relevant for all eternity. And that is that within 1,000 years, much of the Torah will no longer be relevant. Much of it will continue to be relevant, but much of it won't be relevant. There's a great deal in the Torah that's in the Torah now that will not be relevant. I won't make it untrue. It just won't be relevant 1,000 years from now. Let me give you some examples. The principal purpose of the Torah is to introduce us to Yahweh. Well, 1,000 years from now, every soul that exists with God will know him. So introducing us to Yahweh is no longer relevant. Doesn't make what's there untrue. It's just we've already accomplished that goal with 100% of those who are now with Yahweh at the end of the millennial Shabbat. The second most important aspect of the Torah is to introduce us to the covenant and present the terms and conditions and the benefits of the covenant. Everybody that will be with God at the end of the millennial Shabbat will be a member of the covenant. They will have known the terms and conditions. They will have acted upon them. They will have already received the benefits. No reason to represent them. Doesn't mean that they're not valid still. They are valid, but there's no reason to present them. The seven invitations to meet with God lead us from our imperfect world to God's perfect world. Now, I think we're going to continue to celebrate them throughout all time, but we're going to celebrate them based upon what they meant and just an opportunity to have these wonderful parties with God and celebrate their relationship. But in terms of their purpose, which is to make us, A, immortal, we're already immortal, B, perfect, we're already perfect, C, adopted, we're already adopted, D, enriched. We're already enriched. God's going to put a copy of his Torah inside of us. And E, empowered. Everyone is already empowered. Then you go to the fact that the Torah, like all fatherly advice, that was the point we spent so much time on yesterday, that the Torah, like all fatherly advice, also has the consequence for doing things that are not conducive, that are not healthy, that are not beneficial. Well, there's no reason to tell us what the consequence is of choosing to ignore or rebel against God's instructions when, in fact, that everyone has chosen to accept them who has survived. So why even, there would be no purpose, in fact, it would be counterproductive to have those aspects of the Torah's guidance go forward. So there will be a Torah lowercase t. It won't contradict any aspect of the existing Torah, but what it's going to do is eliminate those things that no longer have a function in eternity amongst God's children, and it's going to have to add a great deal. And that is, it has to add the kind of things that will enable us to continue to exercise free will without doing stuff that endangers us or others. You know, we're going to be playing with enormous power and be able to explore the universe. I don't know in eternity whether or not it would be dangerous for us to approach a black hole. Don't know. I don't know if it would be dangerous for us in the spirit form to investigate how a star creates its light. I don't know if it would be, if it's how we would go about examining the building blocks of matter. I don't know how we will be able to interact with life forms without potentially endangering them. And so we're going to need that kind of guidance. And our Heavenly Father is absolutely going to give it to us. So when He writes His Torah inside of us, there's going to be a variation of His Torah that is perfect for the millennial Shabbat, and there'll be a variation of His Torah that goes for eternity thereafter. We'll return to this passage tomorrow, or on Monday. May God bless.